I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
Disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find out more about us by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. Tonight's episode and subject matter is very personal to me. It's something that I've wanted to produce for a while, but I wanted to get it just right. Richard James Edwards was a renowned British rock star and lyricist who hailed from the small town of Blackwood in South Wales. He was one of the founding members of the alternative rock band the Manic Street Preachers in 1986, along with his close friends James Dean Bradfield, Sean Moore and Nicholas Jones. Despite his mysterious fate, Edwards left an indelible mark on the music industry with his dark, poetic and thought-provoking lyrics. Indeed, his lyrical prowess, coupled with his musical input, made him an archetypical rock star and one of the most influential British lyricists of his time, but more so as a lightning rod for adolescent angst. Edwards' lyrics often explored themes of politics, society, culture, and existentialism. He drew inspiration from the works of authors such as Albert Camus, Philip Larkin, and J.D. Salinger, while his stage presence and poetic persona were reminiscent of Jim Morrison and Ian Curtis. Richie Edwards' impact on rock music continues to be celebrated and remembered. His lasting image is one of emotion, intellectual poetry, and an 80s and 90s zeitgeist genius with his struggles with internal demons. Richard James Edwards was born on December the 22nd, 1967, in Blackwood, Wales. Blackwood, for those unfamiliar with the place and for our overseas listeners, is a small town on the Sahawi River located in the South Wales valleys. Blackwood is part of the historic county of Monmouthshire. It was founded in 1820 by John Hodder Moggridge, a colliery or coal mine owner. As you can imagine, Blackwood's early years were very much with coal mining at the centre of things. It was the main employer in the town, and the town grew as many families moved to the area for the coal mining industry. Unfortunately, the decline of the coal mining industry in the later part of the 20th century, and in particular the 1980s, affected South Wales significantly, and Blackwood was no different. The major source of employment in the town was lost, and the landscape left daily reminders of what had been. A large amount of government-sponsored and private financial rejuvenation has gone into the town over the last 30 years, and Blackwood is now known as a hub of light industrial and high-tech employment firms, while still honouring its rich industrial heritage. Richie Edwards had a happy upbringing, surrounded by the love and support of his parents, Graham and Sherry Edwards. He also had a close bond with his younger sister Rachel, with whom he shared many childhood adventures, and also numerous friends from within his leafy suburban neighbourhood. Growing up in a small town like Blackwood, Richard developed a fascination with music, literature and the arts from an early age. He was known for his exceptional intelligence and creative mind, even at a young age. Richie attended Oakdale Comprehensive School, where he excelled academically, and where teachers noted his above-average performance scholastically, but also of an individual mind. He possessed a natural intelligence, they would say. Throughout his childhood, Ritchie showed a deep love for reading and loved to dig into works that were far beyond his years. As I previously mentioned, he was heavily influenced by renowned authors such as Albert Camus, Philip Larkin, George Orwell, Franz Kafka, and J.D. Salinger. His later lyrical craftsmanship and introspective songwriting style can also be traced back to those early literary influences. Ritchie's musical input started to take shape during his teenage years as he immersed himself in the alternative rock scene of the 1980s. Ritchie, however, didn't play any musical instruments. Following his education at Oakdale Comprehensive School, Ritchie attended the University of Wales in Swansea between 1986 and 1989, where he graduated with a degree in political history. It was while Edwards was attending university that he befriended Nicky Jones, nicknamed Nicky Wire by his friends due to his tall, thin frame. Ritchie and Nicky initially bonded as they had gone to the same school and hailed from the same small town, but they soon realized that they had shared a considerable amount of interests, particularly a love of music and pop culture tastes. Nicky Wire was playing guitar at the time in a punk band called Betty Blue, and Ritchie became the band's driver and photographer, quickly becoming close friends with the other members of the band, Sean Moore and James Dean Bradfield. Whilst it's often stated in biographies for the band, Betty Blue was not started while the friends were at university. Moore, Wire and Bradfield actually started playing together in Bradfield's childhood home while they were in comprehensive school, or high school to our overseas listeners. In late 1988, the bassist for Betty Blue, Michael Flicker Woodward, quit the band and Wire shifted to bass duties. By now, Ritchie had been collaborating with Wire around image, design and song lyrics for the band, artistic elements that came naturally to Ritchie that the rest of the band members thought were a perfect fit for the image that they wanted to portray. It wasn't long before Ritchie was invited to join the band as rhythm guitarist. The fact that he possessed no musical ability and had no idea how to play the guitar was not a problem for the band. They also decided on a name change from Betty Blue. James Dean Bradfield, the band's lead singer, lead guitarist and main musical writer, suggested the Manic Street Preachers after being referred to the name by a homeless man while Bradfield was busking on the streets of Cardiff. Pale and thin and just 22 years old, Ritchie looked like a rock music archetype already, a star already created. He also now preferred to be referred to as Ritchie James, taking his middle name as his surname. Ritchie's guitar was often turned down or off altogether while the band performed on stage. This wasn't an important or an issue to the band. They wanted Ritchie for his intelligent and triggering lyrics and for his rock star image. Ritchie gave the Manic Street Preachers, or the Manics as they would soon be referred to, the edge that they always needed and to be noticed. In August 1989, the band self-released their debut single, which they named Suicide Alley. This was followed up shortly by an EP titled New Art Riot on the Damaged Goods label. Whilst I'm here to talk specifically about Ritchie and not necessarily provide a band biography, I think these two early releases by the band are important. Their EP in particular attracted significant interest from the UK music press, largely due to their attacks on fellow rock musicians and cutting truths which the band arrogantly proclaimed. A management deal followed soon after, as did a record deal with Heavenly Records. A particular lyric which Ritchie wrote for the 1990 track Motown Junk stated, quote, "I laughed when Lennon got shot." This triggered attention and anger from the music press at the time, and the Manics gained a reputation as provocateurs and opinionated rock stars. Their concerts also reflected their image and attitude, and their fans quickly mirrored their idols. Some of the British press referred to them as the second iteration of the Sex Pistols, but the Manics were far more intelligent than that, and Ritchie was keen to prove that in his interviews, lyrics and performances. Even though the opinions and messages the Manics put out might seem barbed and strong, the band quickly won over the music press and gained a huge following. One music journalist in particular, though, questioned the authenticity of the band. Enemy journalist Steve Lamack wondered if the Manics were fake. Were their comments an image and all for show? Did they mean what they preached? On May 15, 1991, Lamack, found his opportunity to pose his thoughts and question the Mannix on their authenticity. The incident has become notorious for what happened next. After the band had played a sellout show at the Norwich Arts Centre, Steve Lamacq was approached by Richie for a quiet word, as Richie put it. About the following incident, Richie said, quote, "I was talking to Steve for an hour, trying to explain ourselves. He saw us as four hero-worshipping kids trying to replicate our favourite bands. There was no way I could change his mind. I didn't abuse him or insult him. I just cut myself to show that we were no gimmick, that we were pissed off, that we are for real." Initially, Lamacq didn't realise what was happening as he was talking to Richie, but eventually he found himself looking down and saw what Richie was doing to himself. Richie, using a razor blade, had carved the word "for real" into his forearm without flinching and without removing his gaze from Lamacq's eyes as he was discussing the honesty of his band. No one was more shocked than Lamacq himself, who helped call an ambulance to Norwich General Hospital for Richie. Lamacq was horrified and left without words. The wound received 17 stitches, and the lurid photographs taken of the gory graffiti would help confirm to teenagers that here was a band who meant it. The Mannix were for real. The effect was astonishing. The Mannix Street Preachers were never seen in quite the same light ever again. The Mannix owned their depression, frustration, and anger. Their growing army of despondent teenagers worldwide heard their call and came in their droves to hear what the band had to say. The incident, however, although extremely powerful and a public image victory for the band, reflected something else. A man who was troubled, emotionally distressed, and someone whose sadness had bubbled over into the public realm. Richie called NME magazine the next day to apologise to Steve Lamacq for any distress that he might have caused him with the stunt. Lamacq asked Edwards if he felt foolish for hurting himself so badly. Richie thought about the question for a moment before replying, quote, "I just feel like the rest of this country, banging my head against the fucking wall." In the wake of the publicity and controversy that followed, the band would sign an even bigger record deal with Sony Columbia Records. It was on this label that the Mannix Street Preachers would release Generation Terrorists, their ambitious debut double album. Each of the 18 songs on the album were accompanied by a literary quotation masterfully compiled by Richie. Generation Terrorists sold over 250,000 copies and established the Mannix Street Preachers as Britain's new indie rock hope. With that hope came bigger shows, more exposure, television interviews, and huge demands on the band members. The troubled man that Richie was revealed to be was by now the focus of intense fan devotion, media attention, and the trapping that came with fame. But his struggles with mental health began showing further signs of increased emotional instability. Richie often burned himself with cigarettes. He practiced self-mutilation, suffered with anorexia nervosa, and alcoholism. This all combined to make Richie increasingly unreliable and vacant. In 1993, the Mannix Street Preachers were the first band of their kind to play in Bangkok, Thailand. They played for two nights to a packed-out NBK hall to an audience of more than 2,000 fans each evening. The opening night was extremely successful as the Mannix played to an entrenched audience. During the encore of their songs titled Motorcycle Emptiness and You Love Us, a journalist took to the left side of the stage to observe blood flowing from Richie's chest. As it turned out, a Thai fan had given Richie a set of ceremonial knives with a note urging Richie to use the knives on himself. The request was fulfilled by Richie, who willingly obliged, slashing himself across the chest several times. Photographer Richard Cummings, who photographed the band that evening, had asked him why he had done it. The answer that Richie gave was thus, quote, "A fan asked me to do it, and I didn't want to let them down." It was also during the tour that Richie was particularly struck by the poverty in the region and found himself becoming increasingly homesick and despondent. On returning back to the UK from Bangkok, the band went straight to work recording their third album, which would eventually become their critically acclaimed masterpiece titled The Holy Bible. They recorded the record in the now defunct Soundspace Studios in Cardiff, which was within walking distance from Richie's apartment in Cardiff's Bay Area. The band's decision to record their album at the location was based on their desire to retake control of their own music's destiny and to return to their roots. The band were all together in Wales between January and May of 1994. Richie wrote most of the lyrics for the album. The band felt that the album and lyrics were uncompromising and true to their roots, something which the surviving members of the band are very proud of to this day. On a personal note, I happen to agree with this opinion. It's one of my most favourite albums ever recorded. No promo, but if you have never listened to the Manic Street Preachers, I recommend this album in particular. As well as Thailand, the Manic Street Preachers toured and recorded extensively from 1992 to 1994, barely taking a break or stopping to appreciate the fruits of their labour and considerable achievements. In March 1994, Richie moved out of his family home in Blackwood and into a flat of his own at Anson Court, which was situated in Cardiff's Bay's stylish Atlantic Wharf area. Richie's new flat, although in a very well-to-do area, was also only across the water from one of the city's most deprived areas. This put him right on the doorstep of local drug dealers. Richie established contact with them, hoping initially to purchase some weed. But as time went on, Richie found it increasingly difficult to avoid the gang, which he'd become involved with. One of the Manic's road crew claimed that Richie had confided in him a chilling story. Richie had allegedly been forced into a vehicle while trying to buy some cannabis and was stuffed into the back seat between two muscular-looking men who drove him around Cardiff for hours on end. But this is not something that Richie had talked about with his close friends. 1994 would prove to be a dark and difficult year for Richie. The band had come to terms with the death of their manager and mentor, Philip Hall, who had sadly died of lung cancer early in the year. Hall was someone who had believed in the band from the very start, and he had shared their vision when everyone else thought that the Manic Street Preachers were fake or a joke. Richie took the death of Hall particularly hard. Richie had grown close to Philip Hall, and he saw Hall's passing as someone who had abandoned him or left him. In April of 1994, Kurt Cobain, the singer and songwriter to the American grunge band Nirvana, had taken his own life. The media immediately drew comparisons between Richie and Kurt, as they saw these two icons as self-destructive and artists struggling with addiction and mental health problems. The press actually speculated if Richie would commit suicide next and when. It was also around this time that Richie's only friend from university, other than Nicky Wire of course, decided to take his own life, something which again hit Edwards incredibly hard. In August 1994, Richie was eventually hospitalised for nervous exhaustion. He was first admitted to NHS Whitchurch Psychiatric Hospital in Cardiff, but his fellow band members felt that Richie wasn't getting the care and treatment that he needed, so he was then transferred to the private Priory Hospital in London. The Priory was a private clinic which specialised in mental health and addiction treatment. The clinic is situated in Roehampton in the southwest London borough of Wandsworth. Many celebrities had been successfully treated at the Priory, including the likes of Carolyn Ahern, Eric Clapton, Kate Moss, Amy Winehouse, Paula Yates, Simon Pegg, Sinead O'Connor, and Johnny Depp, to name just a very small few. It was hoped that Richie would receive the appropriate treatment and get better too, and the band, Richie himself and his family were all very optimistic upon his admittance. Richie's demons were sadly numerous. Anorexia nervosa, depression, insomnia, and self-medication. He sometimes drank until he passed out, desperate to sleep, relying on Jack Daniels to aid his rest. At the time Richie was admitted to the Priory, he was enrolled in the Goldsworthy program, which would treat him for alcohol addiction. But according to sources close to Richie, this angered him, because he felt that this was not his biggest issue. In fact, according to his sister Rachel, he could quite happily take alcohol or leave it. He just relied upon it to get some sleep. Undoubtedly, though, Richie had a severe form of depression that only grew worse as time passed. This was most likely compounded by his lack of natural sleep, and even contributed to his lack of sleep in a vicious circle of consequences. Fellow band member Nicky Wire stated in a 1995 interview that the Priory had taken away Richie's soul, which Richie often bared to close friends and relatives. The Priory, Nicky said, had changed him. By the time Richie left the Priory, he had beaten his drinking problem, but the clinic had left him with a brand new 65 cigarettes a day smoking habit. Richie was often asked about his numerous issues by fans and journalists alike. He was open about his depression and tendency to self-harm. He did, however, state that he did not want to be the poster boy for self-inflicted harm. Richie wrote this in a letter to his on-and-off-again girlfriend, Jo. He stated in the letter, quote, "Everybody wants me to chop off my arm or something, on stage. It's like they're waiting for a car crash to happen. But it's a shit thing to be remembered for." Whilst Richie was in the Priory, the Manics temporarily played on as a three-piece. As Richie's guitar was usually turned down during the performances, the band's sound was not particularly affected by his absence, although this triggered a sense of futility in Richie, as he felt that he wasn't needed, that he was a spare. In September 1994, Richie rejoined the band for the remainder of the European tour. The band's final live appearance on the tour was at the London Astoria to a sold-out 2,000-capacity crowd. It was a memorable performance, ending with the band smashing their equipment and the lighting rig, causing over £26,000 worth of damage. The Manics finally released The Holy Bible, the album I previously mentioned, towards the end of this tour, in August 1994. With a Jenny Saville painting on the cover, The Holy Bible cemented the Manics' place in the British rock establishment. Both critically acclaimed and a hit with the fans, The Holy Bible was a huge success on all fronts. It didn't, however, sell the volume that the record company would hope for. Most of the Holy Bible's lyrics were written by Edwards, and, under the influence of Sylvia Plath, express his depths of depression. Richie read and wrote a lot throughout his life, but it increased greatly during this period. Friends and those close to Richie recall that it was perhaps the most creative period in his life. He had become fascinated with the work and lives of notable people, who, on the cusp of success or in their prime of their career, had turned their backs on society and simply vanished from the public scene. Like French poet Arthur Rimbaud, visual artist William Burroughs, novelist Sylvia Plath, and writer and chemist Primo Levi. Additionally, and worth noting, I feel, that it was disappearing from the public eye was not a new concept to Richie. Whilst growing up, Richie was made aware of his great aunt Bessie, who had shut herself away from the world and become a recluse. He admitted that the sound of this sort of lifestyle was fascinating. He also had an uncle Shane, who had left his native Wales to study in the United States and had not contacted the family for over 5 years. The notion of going off-grid like his relatives was something that Richie was all too aware of, and something that his sister Rachel knew her brother was intrigued with. Shortly after Richie left the Priory Clinic, he was hit by yet another setback. His beloved dog of 17 years, Snoopy, sadly died. Richie had grown up with the dog and was incredibly close with him. The situation was compounded by Richie's fragile mental health at the time. As a tribute to Snoopy, Richie and his sister Rachel planted a tree in the garden of their parents' home. This would be the last time that the Edwards family ever saw Richie. In January of 1995, the Manics were working at the House in the Woods studio in London, where they were writing and demoing tracks for their next album. On the 23rd of January 1995, a week before his disappearance, Richie gave his final ever interview to a Japanese magazine called Music Life. In the interview, Richie was very critical of the music industry and the effects and expectations of fame. Just 8 days later, on the 31st of January 1995, Richie and James Bradfield were both checked into a London hotel. They were staying at the Embassy Hotel on the Bayswater Road. From there, they would be scheduled to fly to the United States to promote the Holy Bible album the following day. Richie had not been keen on going to America initially, but James said that on the night before his departure, he actually seemed happy and at peace with things somehow. Prior to checking into the hotel, Richie and James stayed in the hotel car park, sitting in Richie's car for a short while. They had a conversation about which of their newly written songs they liked and ideas for upcoming tours, following which they both checked into their separate hotel rooms. The pair were actually staying in adjoining rooms. They spent half an hour freshening up, after which James walked into Richie's room. Richie was in the bath, so James decided to give his friend another half hour. James made the suggestion of browsing at a nearby shopping centre. Richie suggested a cinema trip might be more enjoyable instead, to which James agreed. Richie later changed his mind and decided to stay in his room whilst James went out anyway. Richie had told James that his friend Vivian, whose last name is unknown, was planning to visit him in his hotel room that night, so he couldn't go out with James after all. Richie called his mother, and during his call, he told her that he wasn't looking forward to going to America. James and Richie were set to meet in the hotel lobby on the morning of February the 1st. From there, they would head to Heathrow Airport. When Richie didn't turn up, James was naturally concerned, as Richie was known to always be punctual. Although James's first assumption was that Richie had simply overslept. James sought the help of hotel staff and together they accessed Richie's hotel room, room 561. Richie was nowhere to be found, neither were any of his belongings. The bath had been left filled to the brim with water, which was stone cold. A box had been placed on the table. It was covered in literary quotes, collages and pictures, which included Bugs Bunny and a Germanic-style house. Inside the box were a number of books and videos, titles including the 1993 Mike Leigh-directed British drama Naked and the 1977 Richard Burton movie Equus. The box had been addressed to a girl named Jo, a girlfriend of Richie's at the time, with a note that simply read, "I love you." As it transpires, Richie had left the hotel at 7 a.m, carrying just his car keys, passport and wallet, hotel staff had confirmed. His suitcase containing all of his clothes were left behind at the hotel. He had driven his car along the M4 motorway back to his apartment in Cardiff, some 147 miles or 236 kilometres away. As soon as Richie's parents were informed about the situation, they travelled to his apartment in Cardiff, where they found his passport. Once the police were involved later that day, following a missing persons report by Richie's family, they were quickly able to determine that in the 2 weeks before the band was due to leave for America, Richie had begun withdrawing £200 from his bank account every day, amassing almost £3,000 in total during that time. It's worth noting here that this cash has never been found or accounted for. What I mean by this is that it's never been found amongst Richie's belongings, at his flat, in his London hotel room, or in his car, which would later be recovered. At the time of Richie's disappearance, he was reading a book titled Novel with Cocaine by Russian writer M. Agiev. The book is a Dostoevskian psychological novel which features and explores ideas such as the interaction between psychology, philosophy, and ideology. It also tells the story of the writer who stays in a mental hospital before staging his own disappearance. The fact that Richie was reading this book might mean everything, or nothing at all, but it's certainly in keeping with the fascination to vanish off the grid and never be heard of again. On the 17th of February 1995, around 2.5 weeks after he was last seen, his car, a silver Vauxhall Cavalier, was found abandoned at the Severn Bridge service station. The location is a notorious suicide spot given its location next to the suspension bridge that runs over the River Severn between South Gloucestershire in England and Monmouthshire in Wales. The part of the River Severn that the bridge is constructed over is a particularly deep and dangerous location, hence its notoriety for suicide. Strong riptides and fast-flowing water makes it difficult for anyone who ends up in the water to survive. The bridge marks the area where it flows into the Severn estuary and ultimately discharges into the Bristol Channel and eventually the Celtic Sea. After locating Richie's car, South Wales police were quick to assume that Richie had driven to the spot to end his own life. While there was sufficient circumstantial evidence to believe that other events had actually transpired. The car had received a parking ticket 3 days before on February the 14th, which evidenced that the car had been there for a while. Inside the recovered vehicle were family photographs from Christmas just 6 weeks prior. The battery was flat and the steering wheel had been locked with a steering lock which was common at the time. There were also some music cassettes scattered about, an assortment of McDonald's fast food wrappers, and some empty bottles of wine. It appeared that the car had been lived in for a while. Richie didn't drink wine, however. Firstly, he hadn't touched alcohol since leaving the Priory, but more so, when he did drink alcohol, he exclusively drank bourbon, Jack Daniels in particular. Again, this could be nothing or everything. The police didn't think that the car had any significant link to Richie's disappearance and did not conduct any forensic tests on the car, not even any simple fingerprint checks. In what some people consider as being particularly cold in their approach, on the same day that the car was found, the police simply informed the Edwards family and requested that they immediately pay to have the car towed to their home in Blackwood, a distance of some 33 miles. On closer inspection of the car by family and friends, a toll receipt from when Richie is alleged to have crossed over the Severn Bridge back into Wales was of particular interest amongst the items. It was time-stamped for the 1st of February 1995 at 2:55 a.m., meaning Richie would have left his London hotel at around midnight to have reached the bridge crossing at 2:55 a.m. So who was the person that checked out of the Embassy Hotel in London as Richie at 7 a.m. as the hotel had stated? All things considered, it's possible that Richie could have left his hotel room at midnight, travelling down the M4 motorway via the Severn Bridge and arriving back at his apartment in Cardiff. He could have left his passport, then travelled by the same route all the way back to the hotel in London and arrived in time to then check out at 7 a.m. But the question would be, why? The location where his car was found was on the English side of the Severn Bridge, so there does seem to be some indication that he travelled back across the bridge at some point. But when and why is the question? Having quickly lost faith in the police investigation, the Edwards family took matters into their own hands and reached out to a private investigator to help them track down Richie. With so many loose ends and many questions left unanswered, Richie's family were adamant that there was more to the story and more to be discovered. Richie's sister Rachel has tried on many occasions to identify the woman who was with Richie in his hotel room at the Embassy Hotel. No one had heard of Vivian prior to this night, not his bandmates or family, and the police have not released her identity if they are even aware of it. Following Richie's disappearance, multiple reports of sightings of him were made to the police. A witness by the name of David Cross reported to police that he had spoken to Richie outside of a newspaper and magazine store in Newport, Wales, in the first week of February. Newport is a city situated northeasterly of Cardiff. It's about a 30-minute drive from Cardiff at a distance of roughly 13 miles. It's about halfway between Cardiff and the Severn Bridge that his car was discovered at. Further, a taxi driver from Newport also came forward to make a report to police with a strange story. He claimed that Richie had been one of his passengers. He stated that he had picked up his passenger in Newport city centre, where his passenger produced a piece of paper with the Queen's Hotel letterhead. The Queen's was a local Newport hotel. The paper contained several directions for the driver. The taxi driver then proceeded to drive the person he believed to be Richie Edwards around the valleys and on to Blackwood. The taxi driver continued that the passenger spoke with a London East End or Cockney accent, but would occasionally slip into a Welsh accent, leading him to believe that the passenger was not using his true accent. Once the taxi driver arrived at the town of Blackwood, the passenger also asked if the driver minded if he laid down flat on the back seat. Eventually, the taxi driver took his passenger to the Severn Bridge service station, where the passenger exited the vehicle and paid a fare of £68. A taxi cost of £68 in 1994 adjusted to 2024 value comes in at roughly £174, which is how much a journey from Newport to the Severn Bridge via Blackwood would cost. Additionally, Richie was also seen by a postman who recognised him on the morning of February 1, 1995. The postman, David Rasmus, was conducting his regular morning post route when he came across Richie standing on a footpath next to the Severn Bridge. Rasmus states that Richie was surprised to see him and slightly startled, indicating that Richie thought he was completely alone. This was prior to Richie being reported missing, so Rasmus thought no further of it. A fourth witness made a sighting of Ritchie again in the Newport area. A fan of the Manics, they were unaware that Ritchie was missing at the time they claimed to have seen Ritchie. They saw him at the Newport bus station, as well as at the passport office, both in central Newport on the same day. The fan, who was wished to remain anonymous, claimed that they had a conversation with Ritchie about a mutual friend before they parted ways. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary, the witness stated. Over the years, sightings have been reported from all over the world, from Goa in India to the islands of Lanzarote and Fuerteventura, and even Israel. But sadly, none of these sightings have ever brought with them any answers as to what happened to Ritchie Edwards. So what did happen to Ritchie? The circumstances surrounding his disappearance have sparked countless theories and speculations. Some suggest that Ritchie's fascination with disappearance had caused him to do just that and follow suit, leading to rumours of fake death. No body has ever been found for Ritchie, and ultimately, every lead in the case has resulted in a dead end. Some theorise that Ritchie was in trouble with a drug gang in Cardiff. Speculation is that the gang kidnapped him from the hotel in London and took him back to Cardiff, following which one of the gang members impersonated Ritchie at the 7 a.m. hotel checkout, and he was then murdered by the gang, who staged the scene for it to appear that he may have committed suicide. Personally, I find this theory, if you can even call it that, very far-fetched and unlikely. There's very little to no evidence to support this outcome, not to mention at the time of his disappearance he was sober and had not been in contact with said gang for around a year. Even so, the gang had only sold him marijuana for the most part. They weren't the minions of El Chapo. Another possibility, and far more likely, is that he drove back to his apartment leaving the hotel at midnight, and that somehow hotel reception was mistaken about him checking out at 7 a.m. I feel that this scenario is the most likely. How many customers at a busy London hotel come and go each day? Also, with staff shift changes, I would imagine it's very difficult to remember the movements of all customers coming and going and the times thereof. After this element of the story, though, things get difficult to be sure of. The assumption by police is that once Ritchie was back in Wales, he decided to lay low in Newport for a while, taking a taxi to his hometown for old time's sake and for one last look at his childhood home, and then, when he was dropped off at the 7 service station, took his own life. The problem with this theory is, Ritchie's body was never found. Also, Ritchie, whilst he had some mental health issues for sure, he was very self-aware and he always stated that he would never take his own life. In fact, in 1994, the year before his disappearance, he was quoted as saying the following, quote, "In terms of the S-word, that does not enter my mind, and it has never done in terms of an attempt. Because I am stronger than that. I might be a weak person, but I can take pain." Then, there's this probable theory to consider. Did Ritchie stage a disappearance and vanish because he did not want to be found? It is significant that he left certain clues behind. The books found in his hotel room weren't random, for example. They all had a common theme: a troubled soul dissatisfied with the status quo and the society he finds himself in. Ritchie was known to be very interested in stories and documented accounts of people vanishing, disappearing off the grid and starting a new life on their own terms in a place where they are safe and completely unknown. Ritchie even wrote about it as far back as high school English class, where he would hand in essays about him vanishing and living where no one can find him. Would it be too far-fetched to imagine that he was trying to communicate something? In his poems, his lyrics, his interests and the works that he spent a huge amount of time reading? It's no secret that Ritchie was frustrated and often felt misunderstood and unheard. He was alienated and didn't know where to turn for help. During the interview with NME magazine that caused him to carve the phrase "for real" into his skin, it became immediately apparent that Ritchie was communicating, but sadly, no one was able to listen. He opened himself up for help, willingly going to a psychiatric care facility, but unfortunately, they only wanted to treat him for alcoholism, assuming the alcohol was the root cause of his illness, rather than a crutch to cope with more significant problems. The fact that he drank to fall asleep was a symptom. He knew there was something else going on, but again felt let down. Q magazine wrote this about his last album, The Holy Bible. Quote, "The tone of the album is by turns bleak, angry, and designed." Ritchie's sister knows that the Sylvia Plath poem Tulips resonated with Ritchie, and in reading it, she feels she understands what was going through his mind before he vanished. She specifically recalls Ritchie asking her to read the poem at his funeral. Perhaps that was his way of saying goodbye to her. The Manic Street Preachers did not record or perform anything in the months following Ritchie's disappearance. But with the Edwards family blessing, they regrouped and are still playing together today. The band still pay 25% of all their royalties into an account in Ritchie's name. Graham and Sherry Edwards, Ritchie's parents, have sadly now both passed away without ever knowing what happened to their son. Rachel Elias, Ritchie's sister, searched for many, many years for her brother and to try and find answers. Long after her family began to oppose the search, feeling that if Ritchie was out there, he did not want to be found. Ritchie Edwards was declared legally presumed dead in 2008. This enabled his financial matters to be wrapped up. But Rachel continues to look for Ritchie to this day and refuses to give up hope that she will someday know what happened to her only brother. With no sign or trace of Ritchie for 29 years, all we can do is speculate. I personally don't feel it's appropriate to say that I hope someday Ritchie is found, as primarily if Ritchie wanted to disappear, that may be disrespectful to his wishes, and he may have found the happiness that he was looking for. So I suppose I hope the family of Ritchie can find the peace and closure that they need in all of this, and I hope that wherever Ritchie is now, that he is happy, loved, and at peace. In May 1991, the Manic Street Preachers released their second single, titled You Love Us, on Heavenly Records. Whilst the song would be re-recorded and re-released a year later on Columbia Records as part of their first LP, Generation Terrorists, the initial Heavenly single is unique in that it is the only release which featured the B-side titled Starlover. Starlover was written by Ritchie Edwards in late 1990, with James Bradfield, Nicky Wire and Sean Moore adding the music. In 2008, James Bradfield stated that the song was about the band. He went on, quote, "The band as people, wanting and struggling to be the visions of the things that we'd admired, and us trying to live up to the roll call of our heroes." It's with this in mind, and with the song meaning that would echo through Ritchie's disappearance, that I'll end with some of Ritchie's lyrics from the verses of Starlover. "Paint your lips, things fall apart, flowers of hate caress my skin now. Spend my time sucked up inside, mutilation kicks off all you believe in. Sterile wants to spin in my head, I don't need culture, I spit it out. Twist and fall, wounds don't choke, I piss on records, I want to see you dead. A body voice born under torture, leper cult disciples of a stillborn Christ. I worship stone, so lance my eyes. Miles apart from anyone, soma airwaves of killing oxygen. We cue consuming anything. Hate all songs. Aesthetic slavery now."
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.